As we get going this morning, one of the things I want to make a point of is saying that some of where we're headed today is going to be heavy. And I don't know of a way to make it otherwise, nor do I necessarily believe it should be otherwise. I know that can sometimes be a difficult, like saying what I just said can be a difficult way to start out. It might be off-putting to some. I can appreciate that. But as I kind of got into putting together this next installment of our exploration of stages of doubt and belief, my sense was that this one brings us to an important present tense, like happening now kind of intersection, that we need to not duck or kind of turn away from or try to dress up in fancy clothing. We need to just face into some of the things we're going to be talking about. And not just this morning, of course. We're not that unique. this is ongoing. But I think this morning might be a bit of an iteration of that. So just FYI. And I should also say this, it might take a little bit longer, this particular exploration, than some of our mornings do. So you can have that in mind. I'll do my best to move along through it, but it might take a little longer. I do understand that we all see and feel the world differently as people. That's a very intersectional thing. I understand that my lenses are not your lenses and vice versa. I also understand that if we only emphasize individuality and difference, we can end up separated from one another. We can end up, air quotes, free to be ourselves, but adrift from community. We can end up swimming alone in an ocean of possibilities that brings us no comfort because we have no one to consider the possibilities with. And that's not a good space. And it seems like no one, in broad terms, no one knows this reality better than those who sort of stand back and consider it. We didn't get here as a species. We didn't survive as a species by emphasizing individualism. We survived by helping one another. We survived by caring for one another, not by using one another. We need one another. And it seems like the oppressed, those who feel the weight of the day-by-day challenges of living, are the people who experientially know this reality the best. And it seems also, in many ways, like those that are most able to ignore it are those that are surrounded by material abundance, those that assume that having everything we need with relative ease is as it should be for them. And as the gap between those perspectives becomes wider and wider, more and more acutely felt by larger numbers of people, there's a kind of, I believe, there's a kind of critical mass building. It's kind of like a pile of sand that is growing grain by grain and that will, at some inevitable point, collapse. And that sand pile image, by the way, that's an often referenced theoretical model for systemic failure, for the inevitability of systems collapsing. Lots of systems that we make contain that kind of energy that at some point has to come out, and it doesn't always come out in tidy ways. So part of where our exploration today takes us is into the terrain where that stored energy is pushing to get out, and where historic systems are struggling to keep it in, to tamp it down, to make it seem innocuous or invisible or irrelevant. So kind of that sort of an intersection. If history teaches us anything, and of course it's always our choice whether we learn anything from history, isn't it? But if history has anything to teach us, it's that change comes. And when it does, it often looks the least attractive, even the most destructive, to those that are trying the hardest to keep the status quo looking good, appearing viable, appearing reasonable. What's the bumper sticker version of this? Some of you would know this better than I will, but to my recollection, the bumper sticker version is something like, to the privileged, equality looks like oppression. And as a guiding idea, that might be a reasonable one to have in view as we kind of move forward with this exploration today. Okay. So since we're going to get into some deeper water today, I think it's even more important than it might otherwise be to take a moment to breathe together. As always, join or don't join, pick this up or don't pick it up as it works for you. But if you are joining in, then let me offer you this as a possible guiding idea. In light of where I know we're going, and you don't yet, you may wish to breathe today both for yourself and for those that are finding it hard to breathe, in particular because they know we all need one another, but they continue to be systemically treated as not welcome to live and breathe as equals. And they have to find the resilience to breathe not only for themselves, but to lift with each breath the weight of those whose breath has been snuffed out by systemic oppression. It's hard to breathe. Breathe however you wish. I will do what helps me to fill myself as full as I can and to be aware of my breath. I'll do 4 rounds of what I'm doing. Again, if you're listening on the podcast or you're coming back to this later, just hit the pause button here and breathe in the way that that helps you be mindful and aware of your breath. And as if you're taking up my invitation this morning, also aware that you can breathe in support of, be mindful of those for whom breath comes hard because of systemic oppression. So what I'm going to do is I'll consciously breathe in for someone and hold them along with my breath and then breathe that out, and then I'll do that again, and I'll do that 4 times. All right? So let's breathe together. Be comfy. Sit somewhere where you can get your feet flat on the floor if it's possible. Rest your hands on your lap or on your legs. Let your body be calm and breathe deep. Here we go. Peace, everybody. Thank you. If you've been following along in this series, you might be aware that that we've considered stage 1, sort of this infancy or egocentricity, or sorry, stage 0, infancy and egocentricity. We've considered stage 1 as well, which we labeled simplicity, and that we're about to take a deeper dive into stage 2, and we're really just going to get started on that today. And there's a hint about why that's the case in the short name for this stage, which is complexity. So you can imagine that might take a little exploring. But let me start by reaffirming something that I've been saying all along. Despite the perhaps obvious image of stages as being incremental and sequential, what we're doing together at the table in this series is really an attempt to talk about our experiences of things like beliefs and spirituality, which don't tend to behave in tidy linear ways. At least they don't behave that way once we move out of a stage like simplicity. And of course, that's one of the great appeals of a stage like stage 1 of simplicity. As a view of the world, the binary nature of stage 1 has an obvious appeal. It's the kind of way of looking at the world that helps us to keep things in order. It helps us to explain the conundrums. It helps us to answer the big questions in ways that we can explain to our elementary school kids over breakfast and to ourselves in ways that are less likely to keep us up at night. One view of the downside of that way of looking at the world, if we're willing to consider it, might be just as obvious as the appeal. A worldview that says, I'm right, you're wrong, and the best, maybe even the only way forward is if you come over here and see the world the way I do. When combined with structures of power bolstered by things like wealth and technology, that often leads to oppression. Part of what makes this all complex to begin with is that we have either-or realities in our lives, right? It won't do to be philosophical about whether our car is running on empty or not. If we're in the carbon-based system, you know, we either fill up or we don't drive. We pay the mortgage or the rent, or we're out of the house. We eat or we become ill and waste away. Either or is everywhere. It's how a lot of the world functions. However, to take that little list of examples, we can, indeed, we must, think about whether burning fossil fuels is a sustainable practice. We can and must consider if the way we house ourselves might be part of a system that denies adequate housing security to others. We're increasingly aware of the fragility of food security, not just for some marginalized groups somewhere else, but for all people everywhere. So simplicity might help us function, but in the same instant that it's helping us function, it can be adding grains of sand to a pile that is headed for collapse if we don't stop the piling on. And so when we start to doubt the either-ors that we were taught in stage one, including the religious ones, or we start to have experiences that stir up those doubts, we're still typically immersed in dualistic thinking. That's sort of the prevailing norm, in any case, in this part of the world, in the dominant cultures of this part of the world at this point in history. So most of us have been trained in that way of looking at the world. And so that's the vantage point from which we start to have those disconcerting experiences. So it's not unusual for us to feel like the next step when we start to have those experiences of wondering if stage one is going to continue working for us, or maybe feeling like it just isn't working for us, the next step for us might feel like we need to kind of rebel. We need to find a way to look at the world that isn't as simplistic as keep the rules, get the reward. Because we kept the rules and didn't get the reward, perhaps. Or somebody else we saw kept the rules and didn't get the reward. Or we look around us at the world and go, that idea, that worldview just doesn't account for so many things. Now what? So when that binary of right versus wrong stops working, what's next? Well, for lots of people, what's next is asking the pragmatic question, if that doesn't work, what does? It's a shift from asking, what do the big people say is the right thing to do, to asking, how do I win? Or if we think of ourselves as part of a group, how do we win? So instead of right and wrong as our primary focus, as it is in stage one, stage two, it often shifts to something we could call success or failure. So again, we sort of tend to start with a dualism, right? So instead of being motivated in stage two, instead of being motivated by pleasing authority figures or by being right or by being considered right, we start to shift to achieving goals or being successful. Life moves from being a war to being a game. Instead of dividing humans into camps of good versus evil, we tend to start to divide them into winners versus losers. We want to do what works. We want to do what gets us what we want or believe we need. So in this stage, stage two, that way of looking at the world applies to everything, including what we believe. What works becomes our central and most compelling question. I've spent a lot of my life in and around this stage of belief. I have very clear memories of conversations within religious organizations I was working with about how so-called best business practices were the key to winning the world over to our beliefs. Now, of course, we didn't talk about our beliefs that way because to do so would be tantamount to considering that there might be other beliefs or systems of belief that are worth considering, and that was not on the agenda. No, this was about winning the world for God in the name of Jesus and making sure that the converts were well-versed in the theology and the dogma and the social values of the evangelists. The working assumption was that we weren't just saving souls, we were saving the world. In other words, what we believed was the ultimate path forward, the ultimate path to success, both now and forever. I once heard someone describing the building of church infrastructures, church buildings, as viewed through the lenses of pre-modern, modern, and postmodern worldviews, by saying something like this. The pre-modern, generally that sort of period of history, Middle Ages on, the period from which we got things like the doctrine of discovery, if you remember us talking about that. So the pre-modern might answer the church infrastructure question with something like, how grand a roof can we make? How great a symbol of power of our one true God can we build? And the modern might say something like, how much roof can we build for X amount of dollars? And the postmodern might say, why do we need a roof? Why are we building roofs? That how much roof can we make for dollars X? That's a very stage two kind of perspective. We could extrapolate from that. We could expand it into things like, what programs do we need to run to be successful, to get people in the doors, to grow the influence of our tribe? What sort of gospel, what sort of good news do we need to preach? That last one's actually pretty easy to answer in context. We need to preach the formulas for success. We need to talk about the 5 steps to having a perfect marriage, the 3 steps to having happy kids that'll never turn out to be anything but cisgendered and straight and will never need a therapist. The 6 steps to how to have the kind of faith that means God will bless your business ventures and make you rich, and so on. In other words, we need to have this do what works approach, this what will help us be the winners, not the losers approach to what we're saying. Now, that is clearly me being critical of some of the values of this stage. There are also, as in every stage, some significant strengths that are present typically for stage two folks. Stage two includes strengths like enthusiasm, an eagerness to learn, idealism, and action. You get a room full of stage two folks, and you can seriously get stuff done. You might be able to win the world. But hold on. Is winning the world a good idea? That's a powerful idea. It's a heady idea. What happens when you plug stage two values into cultural constructs that include what I would call power multipliers? Things like fortunate geography, wealth, social position, vertical power, religious monopolies, military might. What happens when you bring that, what works for me, what makes me a winner, into association with those kind of variables? What kind of cultures and subcultures do you get when you form them around an idea like we'll do whatever we need to do in order to succeed in our mission? This past month, the August issue of Maclean's magazine, there was an article called "The War Inside the Military." And that article was talking about the internal culture of the Canadian Armed Forces, and it included this paragraph. The Canadian Armed Forces, as an institution, has a necessarily coercive culture. Leaders must have a high degree of authority and control over their subordinates in order for the military to be effective when it is called into action. But the checks and balances meant to stifle the ugly side of that coercion. An instinct to demonstrate power with subjugation, humiliation, and harm are deficient. There are many things that I find both interesting and deeply troubling about that short paragraph. One of them is the assumptions running in the background of a phrase like necessarily coercive culture. Necessary for what? Well, the writer of the article says in the next sentence, to be effective. In other words, to win. In the history of the military, winning most often means destroying, it means undoing, it means gaining the surrender of your adversary, who is not, by the way, also human and not just your adversary or the enemy. But we all get it, right? If the sergeant says charge, you charge, or the whole system breaks down. It's how you get the job done. And in terms of stage theories, the kind of framework we're working in, it's like the ultimate mashup of stage one authoritarianism and stage two efficiency. It all depends on the shared assumption that our versions of success, of right governance, of proper economic systems, of a good society are the right ones that need to be visited on others by whatever means is ultimately, to use the writer's word, effective. This is tricky terrain, and I want to tread both carefully in it and boldly in it. I don't want to back off, but I also don't want to be naive or, for that matter, misunderstood, of course. This could all sound like bashing the Canadian military. which is not what I'm on about here. These realities that that quote refers to and that the wider article examines within the military don't necessarily mean that we shouldn't have a military, any more than the existence of something like residential schools means that we shouldn't have education or schools. It's considerably more complicated than that. But for now, in this context, I want us to take a moment to consider that that ugly side that the writer referred to. In particular, what about what the article's author calls the, quote, instinct to demonstrate power with subjugation, humiliation, and harm? Does that just fall under, you know, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet? That's sort of that kind of rationale, that the sort of thing that gets rolled out to explain the costs of do what we believe we need to do in order to win? Because that's often sort of the relationship that's drawn there. For a long time, in the context of the military, according to the article, that's exactly what has happened. And as the writer goes on to explain, it's happened over and over again within those structures. And it's been hidden from the public view by internal loyalties and structures that steamroll the victims and silence their stories. But increasingly, as the people that have been abused by that instinct to demonstrate power with subjugation, humiliation, and harm keep speaking up, and as the culture that made their silencing possible shifts and fractures, the authoritarian sandpile of win at all costs is getting closer to critical mass and collapse. As is, I believe, the sandpile of religious authoritarianism, comprised of the versions of belief that have been cozy with institutional power and those kind of structures and systems since the Middle Ages. Versions of religion powered by we are right and we have the right to take the world in the name of God. I expect this is from a movie poster, you know, but I have this mental image of Columbus hitting the beach and slogging up through the surf and planting this flag and claiming a continent for God and country. And the fact that he's geographically lost at that exact moment is one that is glossed over in my education. But it's one that feels increasingly like a poignant part of the narrative to me as it becomes more and more clear that he wasn't just geographically lost, he was ideologically adrift as well when that happened. And here's why I would say that. In that moment, I don't imagine him saying, hey folks that are already here, we're here to share the wealth. I imagine that literally or otherwise, it's something more along the lines of, we did it! We found this new world and it's ours for the taking. Why? Because we took the risks, we sailed off over the horizon, we put it all on the line and we won. The world is ours. From where I sit in the 21st century, I don't even have to use my imagination to picture the disconnect that happened hundreds of years later when other European colonizers signed treaties on this land where we are that one party understood to be an opportunity to share with equals, and the other party understood as exercising their God-given right to resource extraction at any cost, including the demonstration of power over other human beings with subjugation, humiliation, and harm. I don't have to use my imagination to see that because the first peoples of these lands are telling their stories out loud in ways that can't be ignored or sidelined or silenced any longer. As it turns out, getting things done does not necessitate a coercive culture. And all I have to do to know that is pull my head out of the sandpile of my privilege and listen. I want to leave us with two stories today, both of which I hope can help us begin to undo the clearly destructive stage two idea that whatever works or whatever gets the win for me and mine is categorically good, and to turn our imaginations toward asking what we might better do with those potentially good stage two values of enthusiasm and eagerness to learn and idealism and a bias to action. The first story I'm just going to refer to, and the second I want to read for you in its entirety. The first story that I want to reference in this context is a Jesus story in which Peter, who is in many ways at this point in the story, sort of an archetypal stage two individual. He is enthusiastic, he is eager, he is action oriented, he's an idealist, and he's an early adopter of the teachings of Jesus and his understanding of them and what that means. And so in that the fervor of that, he lops the ear off a servant that he perceives as getting in the way of his understanding of what a win would look like for Jesus. Only to have Jesus repair the injured ear and to have stern words with Peter that run along the lines as we have the story of Peter, no more of that. No more. It's an interesting story. It occurs in all four of the Gospels. So clearly, whatever happened historically had the attention of the writers. As is almost always the case, the details of those accounts vary in some cases considerably, but what is consistent, and these are the things that tend to grab my attention in enduring stories, are the consistent themes. What is consistent in all the versions of those stories as we have them is that the rabbi's way toward a better world clearly does not hinge on subjugation, humiliation, and harm. Even, perhaps especially, of those not like us. I think that's worth noting. The second story, the one I want to read for us, is an article by a writer named Tennille Campbell. Tennille Campbell is a Dene Métis photographer and writer from the English River First Nation in Saskatchewan, based in Saskatoon. This story is taken from the same issue of Maclean's as the quote about the military that I've been referencing so far. And I want this voice to speak without, as much as is possible in this context, without an intermediary of my commentary for sure. And so I'm just going to read you the article and then I'll wrap things up. When I first heard in June about the sprawling unmarked burial where 215 children were found at the Kamloops Indian Residential School in BC, I skimmed the article, taking note of who and where, how and when. I sighed deeply, shaking my head, and then read the next story. That sounds callous, and I hesitate to even mention it, but trauma is not new to Indigenous people, and sometimes it's hard to endure yet another story. This is our reality. But as the news was picked up, appearing in hundreds and thousands of social feeds, I realized I would have to talk to my daughter again about a trauma that she would hear about, be it from a misinformed classmate or on the news. I picked up Ari from a sleepover on Sunday morning, and we sat in the car. I told her about the 215 children found and what that meant. I told her about the mini residential schools that operated in Canada and how the last one only closed in 1996. I told her about the residential schools that were on our reserve and how her papa had attended and when it had been torn down. I told her about the first time I heard stories of unmarked graves, of babies being buried, and how I didn't believe it. I was quite young, younger than her. I was ignorant then, and I didn't want her to grow up ignorant in this world. So, even though these stories are hard to hear, hard to feel, it's important we honor them, that we witness them. She was quiet, and I wiped my tears. I didn't even realize I was crying. "Are you sad because this could have happened to Papa?" she asked. I nodded, knowing Eri had grieved for the grandfather she knows as Papa ever since she found out about him attending. Papa is alive and well, but her heart still hurts for him. Every September 30th, as swarms of classmates wear orange and listen to stories of residential schools as part of the past, Eri sits in that space of living history. The granddaughter of a residential school survivor, she understands so much, but she still can't comprehend why people would steal children from their homes and families. While I held her warm hand in mine, I explained that there was a call-in for people to bring shoes to represent the children stolen, and she nodded. We went home, And she came out of her room with the shiniest, blingiest gold-colored shoes in her collection, saying, "I think a little girl would have liked these." And then we stood witness under a hot sun, listening to a tiny, powerful child sing at the big drum on the steps of the St. Paul's Catholic Co-Cathedral in Saskatoon. A friend I hadn't seen since the start of the pandemic came over, wrapping an arm around me. No words were needed. Grief is sometimes silent, shown in a mutual deep breath. We showed Ari how to smudge her gold shoes and where to place them amid the growing pile. We let the sun burn down on our shoulders, silent, present. I am exhausted. So tired of having to explain to my 9-year-old daughter the atrocities of the past and the present that happened to Indigenous people. I am tired of watching the light in her eyes die every time she comes to the realization that people hate us because of who we are, what we represent. The pride in knowing our roots and our history and where we come from is always in direct conflict with the ideas of the Canadian history shown in textbooks and explaining the term genocide and how it applies to her, to us, is a soul-wearying moment. I'm tired. But I'm tired within my community, and I'm grateful for that. For the hugs, for the texts, for the messages, for the songs sent, for the love felt. I'm not alone in my grief. And I see you all. Fam, be gentle with yourself. And for my non-Indige readers, consider donating to the Residential School Survivor Society. If you are unable to do so, please educate yourself by reading books by Indigenous authors about residential school, but also about Indigenous joy. Understand that yes, residential school happened, and we are still processing the effects of that today, and that we are more than just resilient. We are more than just survivors. We are complex, diverse, creative, and strong. Watch the movies by Indigenous producers and directors about our stories and our lives. Go out of your way to support Indigenous businesses and startups. Listen to the many podcasts out there by Indigenous creators on matriarchs, on love, on relationships. We still mourn, but as the initial shock passes, I can only hope that my non-Indige readers and community continue to seek systemic change for themselves and with us collectively. My privileged position through all of my life and also in this community would provoke me to comment on what Tennille has written. My slow-growing understanding of how I might best do what Tennille calls together with, collectively, do something helpful is what will, you know, put the damper on that. If you want to read the article, and there's a collection of other articles surrounding it in the August issue of Maclean's from other authors, Cindy Blackstock, among others, well-known voice, Alicia Elliott, there's others there as well. I would encourage that to do you to do that. Available anywhere. Your public library probably has it as well if you can't find the August issue. Let those voices speak. By joining with them and paying attention. This is the intersection that I wanted to get at this morning, if I could, just a little bit. This intersection in our own lived experience where We start to question the things we've been taught. We start to question their simplicity. We start to realize the world is a complex place. We still have the drives that we have towards self-preservation, toward me and mine, all those kind of built-in things. But we're more evolved than that. At least we can be. We don't have to stay with that simplistic view of the world. We can move on the basis of what we've learned there. We can move beyond there. We can move into a more complex engagement with the world. And we won't stop at stage two. We'll keep going. But in stage two, one of the things that can happen is our desire to learn, our enthusiasm to take knowledge and apply it to the world to make it better, can be challenged by this kind of an intersection where we ask a question like, is winning for me and mine at whatever cost? Costs that involve things like subjugation and humiliation. Is that a good idea? Is it the only way forward? The only good way forward? Or can my hunger to learn more and to grow and to change carry me forward into something beyond that? All right. Thanks for listening. That's where I'm going to leave it today. And I do look forward to seeing many more of you in person in the coming days and months. That remains a lively hope for me. Peace to you all.